Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 466th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also a professor at the University of Alberta. And today we have brought, as promised, we brought Jamie back to talk more about COPD and puffers. But Jamie, can you first just give us a quick rundown of who Jamie is?
Yes, for sure. So I am an associate professor at the College of Pharmacy at the University of Manitoba. I'm a pharmacist in the Department of Family Medicine at the Kildonan Medical Center in Winnipeg.
And we're going to continue from our previous podcast, and Mike is going to encapsulate what we talked about in that last podcast, and it will be epic.
Yeah, well, it's going to be very quick. So we talked about just starting different puffers and kind of the short acting for the people who are intermittently or mild, very mildly symptomatic, then progressing to a single long acting puffer, a LAMA or a LABA. We talked about the benefits of that over the short acting. It was somewhere around for a moderate exacerbation was moderate or severe was somewhere around 3 to 6% absolute improvement. And for a severe was about 3% absolute improvement. And then for the different quality of life and shortness of breath scores, it's somewhere around a 10 to 15% improvement to reach a minimal clinically important difference. But remember, that standard is quite low. The what is minimally important, you may perceive as quite a small change. Mm-hmm. Then we looked at adding on two puffers versus two long-acting versus one, and that's a LAMA and LABA versus either one alone. And for moderate to severe exacerbations, the benefit was about 2.5%. So compare that to the 3 to 6. Just Jamie's theme was that you get a diminishing returns as you progress in therapy. And I think that demonstrates that. And then for nothing for severe exacerbations, and then for the minimal changes, who responds, it might be as little as only kind of 6 to 7%. In this group. Could be better, but might be as little as 6 or 7% instead of the 10 to 15 we saw with the switch from short to long acting.
And then just also the natural fluctuation of exacerbations is so much that it's tricky to use that as an endpoint, and also just the natural fluctuation of symptoms. We haven't spent too much time talking about guidelines because we decided that we're going to actually involve, we're going to somehow engage the what happens to the patient in the decision.
Yeah, make it relevant for them, to the individual patient. But Jamie, you're going to, I think the next step involves a couple things. I think it involves inhaled corticosteroids, but you could either do that as one of the bronchodilators long acting plus the inhaled corticosteroid, or actually just the triple therapy. But why don't you, I mean, we've only figured out in the last 10 years or so the importance of or the risk associated with pneumonia. And so why don't you take us a little bit through that? Because that's the other puffers don't really have a lot of adverse event profile, but certainly there's more when you're talking about adding in inhaled corticosteroids.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Going back, I was in my PharmD class with James, and James was talking about the evidence, and at that time inhaled corticosteroids really had one trial, and it was the ISOLD trial, BMJ in 2000, and it was about 750 patients, which is pretty small by today's standards, and that's what was available at the time. And then in 2007, as I mentioned the last podcast, the TORCH trial came out, and that was Glaxo's funded trial, 2007, game changer in the eyes of a lot of people, and it looked at an inhaled corticosteroid with a long-acting beta agonist, and it compared it to all of the components and compared it to placebo, which was odd. They were allowed to use PRN inhalers, but it basically compared to all, and it was a huge trial for that time, and still by today's standards, it was over 6,000 patients. It ran for 3 years, and it showed a reduction in moderate to severe exacerbations over just the LABA by itself, which was really the question that most people were interested in. The problem that arose, and this wasn't a big part of the conclusions of the study, but it was fairly evident if you took a look at the adverse event tables, was that there was an increase in pneumonias in the inhaled corticosteroid group. And a number of years later, in 2013, Sammy Suiza from McGill, he wrote a really nice article, and he's wrote some good commentary since then on this topic. And he said if you appropriately apply numbers needed to treat and numbers needed to harm, so the numbers needed to treat, applying that to COPD exacerbations and harm to pneumonias that are caused, what you would find in the TORCH trial was that the number needed to harm was quite a bit smaller than the number needed to treat, which is obviously not a good thing. And I think of a moderate to severe exacerbation in pneumonia to probably be not all that different when it comes to, you know, the negatives that has on patient outcomes, if you guys agree with that.
Yeah. No. I think that they can be comparable, especially like people are talking about, and I think you'll talk about what did count as a pneumonia in these trials and that kind of thing. Obviously, when we think of pneumonia, we think of something very serious. But so can some COPD exacerbations. As you mentioned, the number trade-off does not look like it's in favor of inhaled corticosteroids.
Yeah. And so the absolute numbers was, again, we talked about this before, what, maybe about a 2.5% absolute reduction in exacerbations, but a 4 or 5% increase in pneumonias. Mm-hmm. I think those are ballpark the numbers, right, Jamie?
Yeah, it was. I'm trying to remember the exact numbers needed to treat and harm, but yeah, it was difficult to actually pick out the absolute risk reduction. It was just laid out in rates per year, right? Yeah. But it was about a 6% difference in pneumonias actually in that trial.
Yeah.
At the end of 3 years, so that would have been a 3-year number.
That's so it's important to realize that I think you mentioned it was a 3-year trial, and those are the numbers over that period of time, and I think that created the whole discussion got very relatively heated about trying to figure out, does that mean we should or should not use steroids?
Right, you know. Exactly, and I mean I think a lot of us were having that discussion, but. Kind of surprisingly, or maybe not surprisingly, Advair after that trial, so the combination of that steroid and LABA became the biggest player in COPD management for the next decade, right? Despite the fact that it, you know, on paper, it looked like these two were pretty similar when it came to benefits and harms.
Right. Because way back, you know, when all these sort of combinations started, the question was, do you use a steroid with a long-acting beta agonist, or do you use a long-acting beta agonist with a long-acting muscarinic agent, or do you, you know, you had so many potential choices. And when I remember looking at the TORCH trial and other trials, and you go, I can't figure it out, because they're none of them do a whole heck of a lot, especially when you look at the St. George's Respiratory Questionnaire changes and all that sort of stuff. And the only thing that you could sort of hang your hat on is the only one that showed the potential harm was the steroid. So it pushed people away, because it didn't work all that well anyway. You don't want to do any harm. And I think the steroids with the pneumonia, and it's not the only side effect, and it's these side effects are not picked up, is, you know, you also have an increased risk of thrush. And again, it's hard to get a number for that. But it's probably in the, you know, 2 or 3%. And also, a number of people will complain about vocal changes and things like that. And so, right. Whereas you can't really tease out any sort of side effects, if you will, from the long-acting beta agonists or the long-acting muscarinic agents.
Yeah, they're small. And so, Jamie, they actually went ahead and compared LAMA-LABA combination to LABA and ICS. What did they find there?
Yeah, so that was the FLAME trial that came out in 2016. And so the FLAME trial looked at over a year, it looked at about 3,300 patients. And these patients had at least one moderate exacerbation in the past year. But I think the most striking thing is that 75% were gold criteria stage D. So in the most severe category. So 3/4 of people were in that category. So these were probably the sicker patients that we'd be thinking about. And what they found was a 0.2 less exacerbations per patient per year. I always have trouble thinking about how I'm going to tell a patient that, but 1/5 an exacerbation per patient less per year. It was,
maybe this is not the right, but I would say, you know, so you'd have about one less exacerbation per 5 years.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really making some extrapolations, but maybe that's the way to do it.
Yeah, and you can say, you can try and say one less per 5 patients, but that's actually correct. No. Believe it or not, even though it's the same 2 denominators, patients and years, it's becomes more complicated because there are those in there that are having multiple exacerbations and getting counted again and again.
Yeah,
because it's usually not censored data with exacerbations. Yeah. They usually let you accumulate additional ones. So it's the way these are reported, it's been argued that this is one of the reasons why the COPD trials can be deceptive, because we might have one patient with 5 exacerbations and then a dozen patients with 0 and a few in between, and the guy with 5 is affecting the data because he dropped to 3. So anyway, that's a complicated story, but both of you, I understand why it's a challenge to describe what 0.2 means.
Yeah, and I think I've done the approach that James has as well with one every 5 years. With that, again, as James said, assuming that you can extrapolate and that those lines, you know, stay the same over that period of time. But whatever the case, this is a pretty common number that this is a ballpark that we see in a lot of clinical trials in COPD. So it was technically an advantage for the LABA-LAMA group. When they looked at health status, rescue puff use, there were small differences, but they didn't come close to a clinically important difference. But pneumonias, not surprisingly, were more common in the LABA-ICS group with a number needed to harm of 63 over the year. So a small increase in pneumonias with LABA-ICS and slightly more exacerbations with LABA-ICS. So it was certainly on paper, and for the most part, it was a win for the LABA-LAMA group, which kind of put LABA-ICS kind of to the side, I think, in a lot of people's minds, and the guidelines started to reflect that LABA-ICS maybe didn't have that place that it used to have.
I've heard it argued that maybe it was in more severe patients that you'd be thinking about the ICS, but this trial kind of answered that question too. And so I remember thinking early on when we got the TORCH trial and it showed the potential harms of the ICS combo, the inhaled corticosteroid combo, that if we could, we would be better off giving a LAMA and a LABA ahead of an inhaled corticosteroid combination. So, you know, I think this was the direction we were going to head. It's obviously the benefits are quite small. They're very hard to measure to see that small of a benefit. But I think it's the harms that really seal the deal for me anyway.
And if you guys think the listeners, if you think you're confused about what to use, just go read the guidelines because they're because they're as confused as well. Because you know, you'll see in low risk and versus high risk, and they'll be recommending the same therapies.
But the three of us here. Let's say each one of us had COPD, and you were on one agent. Let's call it a LAMA now for convenience. Yeah. Are you going to pick? And you've decided it's worth a shot to try a double agent. Yeah. Would you pick an inhaled corticosteroid combination, or would you first go for a LABA-LAMA combination?
Oh, no. I think that's as clear a decision as you can make right now, that you don't go with an inhaled corticosteroid yet. I mean, yeah. I think that, right. that, and that, and that's, And that, but that's less from a benefit, but more of a harm perspective. So yeah, no, I agree with you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Jamie's going to regale us with stories of eosinophilias and subgroup analysis, though. That's going to change your mind.
you really seem to have a hate on for eosinophils, and
it's just a surrogate marker within COPD that's gotten to be quite trendy.
So that's the sort of the nuance around, you know, which double therapy do you use. And we'll discuss this a little bit at the end. There is also the discussion about cost, and that's another thing, but we'll talk about it in a minute. But that also comes into play. And also, as you guys know as well as I do, that, you know, we really only have three classes of inhalers. We have the beta agonists, we have the muscarinic agents, and we have the steroids. Yet there are a plethora of different versions of those.
And delivery systems.
And all
these nuances.
Yeah. And just so we've talked about this somewhere in one of the other 464 podcasts where, you know, one of the best ways to maintain patent protection is to change the delivery device, because you can do that. They have different patent protections than they do for medications. And so that's why there are so many different inhaler versions of it, whether they're aerosolized or whether they're breath activated we used to have ones where you'd have to puncture a capsule that had stuff in it.
Break a capsule. That was the old Intol.
Yeah, the Intol and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, every one apparently was better than every other one. And, you know,
We should clarify, Intol is sodium chromoglycolate.
Yeah. And so,
not that anybody's using it anymore, but...
But it's... But you know, I was never able to find anything that would suggest that any of the inhalers were any different. There might be some patient preferences about what you could use. So it really comes down to the you know, how they are used, the cost, and, you know, whether or not they actually have any benefit above that. So we've given you hopefully enough numbers and thoughts to think about for double, or
what about the triple?
I think that's the next stuff. That's the next step, right?
Yeah, and Jamie's going to tell us all about every clinical trial ever conceived for triple therapy.
In 5 minutes, yeah.
Yeah.
So, and there are lots of them. And in the last 2 years, I guess, we've had, from what I recall, and there might be another one published already, maybe two, systematic reviews, meta-analyses on the topic of triple therapy, comparing it to dual therapy. So a LABA-LAMA ICS compared to LAMA-LABA. And there's somewhere around probably 13,000 or so patients that you could draw on from clinical trials. When you look at, there's a lot of common ones. There's a mix and match of different ones in different systematic reviews. But when you look at the volume of patients that contribute most, there's the main trial, at least up until 2018, would be the IMPACT trial. And that was, again, over 6,000 patients over about a year. And That was a triple therapy, and in this case, the inhaled corticosteroid was fluticasone compared to a LABA-LAMA, and it also they compared it to an ICS plus a LABA as well, but that wasn't really what we were concerned with. The patient population, again, kind of with the trend over time, has been to include more severe patients, and these patients had an FEV1 of about 45%. You had to have at least an exacerbation in the last year, and 55% had at least two in this trial in the last year, and about 65% of them had golds, category 3 or 4, so on the far end of severity. And so they looked at this over a year, and they found that there was a reduction in moderate to severe exacerbations, and that was about 0.3 per patient per year. So we're seeing, again, that ballpark of somewhere around 0.1, 0.2, 0.3. Hospitalizations were reduced. This is where it gets even more tricky, 0.06 hospitalizations per patient per year. So six one-hundredths of a patient. Interestingly, though, mortality was reduced, and we really hadn't seen this in clinical trials in COPD before. So It was 0.83% was the reduction. And so that's a number needed to treat of about 120 to save one life. And we'll get into that in a bit. And of course, we asked the question, did patients feel better? And again, very similar to what we've seen with other step-up therapies in the past, the St. George's Respiratory Questionnaire, meeting that minimally clinical important difference was a number needed to treat of about 13. So similar to those numbers that Mike started the podcast off as far as percentages go. And the dyspnea, how short of breath did you feel, wasn't reported as far as raw numbers went. They described a subgroup. In describe, I mean, they said how many there were, but they didn't say how they chose that subgroup. And that was a number needed to treat of about 17. So differences were there with triple versus dual therapy. There were a couple of things that struck a number of people. Number one, you could have a history of asthma getting into the trial. You couldn't have a current diagnosis of asthma, but you could have had it in your earlier years of life. As well, more than 70% of patients came into the trial on inhaled corticosteroids. Third catch was that, again, number needed to harm for pneumonia, here it was 34, so an increased risk of pneumonia. So that was really, that's in a nutshell, the IMPACT trial, which was the kind of the biggest trial we had seen on this question to that point.
Yeah, so it almost doesn't ask the question, does adding an inhaled corticosteroid work? It says in people who are already on them, if you stop them in some people, but keep them on it in others, what happens? And so it's kind of a different question, but no one ever mentions that other than you, Jamie, I know, and a few others, but it maybe sound like a nuance, but it's an important nuance because there are other trials where just taking people off inhaled corticosteroids increases the risk for exacerbations. And even so, these are not simple trials to figure out. But this is the, you know, this study, this trial, when it came out, was basically saying, this is why everyone should be on triple therapy.
Because of the hospitalization rates.
Yeah.
One less hospitalization over 18 years.
Yeah.
I mean, now I'm picking up the bad ones. So there is the mortality benefit. It's small, 120, number needed to treat, but it's actually positive. And as Jamie pointed out, we don't see a mortality reduction in very many of these, even when we pool them in meta-analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So there's been a whole bunch of other studies that have looked at this, and people have tried to put all of these studies together, right?
Yeah, exactly. So as I had mentioned, we've got at least three systematic reviews over the last couple of years, 2018, 2019, and each systematic review was able to put some studies together. It really, as always is the case with systematic reviews, they include the things that have the outcomes that they're looking to report on. If you look at Cazola and his group in 2018, they looked at a number needed to treat to prevent one or more exacerbations, and they found that number needed to treat to be 39 in favor of triple. The other two meta-analyses by Zhang and Zayed, they looked at they were able to look at pneumonia and meta-analyze it and found that the number needed to harm was 38 to 39. So the number needed to harm and the number needed to treat, again, looking at different systematic reviews, but they come out to be essentially the same.
Yeah, but it was always tricky, and I can't remember exactly how they did this, but, you know, an acute exacerbation could easily be pneumonia, right? And so
right.
How did they figure that one out? I know there's been a big discussion about that, because are you either double counting or what are you doing? You know, what's happening there?
Yeah, and I would have loved to be in that clinical trial and listening to the discussions that went on, because it's, I mean, they give not a lot of of information in the clinical trials on how they determine this. So they would have based it on how the patient presented clinically. And if you look at the IMPACT trial, for example, in their safety assessment discussion, they used supporting radiography for incidences of pneumonia. So it's really nondescript. And so a lot of people have drawn on that to say, how do we know what an exacerbation was? How do we know what a pneumonia was?
Yeah. And is it fair to say you get a reduction in exacerbations, but you get more pneumonia, therefore they balance each other out? I don't think anyone, at least I've never seen anyone give a great answer to that.
Right.
Nothing personal, Jamie. I just didn't. But Mike, I know you have a good answer to that.
But
you're not going to tell anyone.
Kind of things. Not unless there's money flowing.
Yeah. That we'll do that in podcast 666.
Yes. Always inappropriate, James. Thank you. To me, this is pretty much a wash. I mean, it's concerning to me. I'm sure some of my pulmonary colleagues will tell me that the exacerbations are more important. I don't know, unless somehow that gets teased out, the number of days in hospital that were associated with the pneumonia ones versus the exacerbation ones. I'm not sure. But it to me, this, like, I rarely progress now to triple therapy. It would have to be pretty dramatic for me to consider that, and I think I'd be entering some of the other thoughts, like other interventions like reflumilast or those kind of things. And certainly, I think, Jamie, I don't know if you're going to talk about it maybe in the next podcast, but sending to respiratory therapy and things like that can also have some benefit for some patients. So it's I'm not sure how quickly I would jump to if it were me. With the condition, I'm not sure. I don't say I never would, because desperate times would maybe push me that way. But it certainly wouldn't be the first on my list of other options for me.
And they don't mention the potential for thrush and hoarseness and all those sorts of things. So, but now you talked about the exacerbations, but what about the quality of life, Jamie?
Yeah. So you won't be surprised. When they looked at, so again, the St. George Respiratory Questionnaire, looking at that 4-point difference overall, it wasn't a statistical, it was a statistical difference, but in most of these trials, patients got halfway to that 4 points, so about 2 overall. So we looked at what is a fairly common baseline of this St. George Respiratory Questionnaire in these trials, and it's somewhere around 45 on that 0 to 100, give or take. And so patients would have dropping means good, dropped to about 43 on average, so 45 to 43. When they looked at responder analysis, it's a the IMPACT trial was 13, number needed to treat of 13. Overall, I think the trials were the systematic reviews report somewhere around 17 as the number needed to treat to be a responder on that. And as I reported for the IMPACT study, dyspnea is poorly reported. It's difficult to find a good answer of whether there was a change in dyspnea or not.
Yeah, so basically what you're saying is, at best, 1 in 10 might feel better on them, but it could be as high as closer to 1 in 20. And I would suggest that because of the fluctuation of that, of COPD, as a clinician and as a patient, you can't pick it up. And that's the sort of eternal debate about this. Do you just give these agents and like a statin and say, we're trying to prevent things? Or do you, because I've seen two authors argue both points, and I don't think either very well. And it's or do you ratchet up these inhalers based on whether or not the patient improves? And neither of those are, I think, legitimate options. I think because of the variation and so on, and the minimal effect, relatively speaking, if we talk about numbers needed to treat of 10 or 20. So what do you do, Mike?
I dodge the ICS bullet in this as long as I can, because I don't, I see their harms and the benefits are so small, but I don't necessarily hesitate too long to start a long-acting puffer at all. That's something I do jump to faster. But it, thank goodness, Jamie's giving me reason to think that my choices haven't always been poor. No,
because not in this case, Mike.
The benefits are better early on. They're still not dramatic by any stretch. This isn't a PPI or general anesthetic or anything like that. These are smaller benefits, but they're certainly the long actings have a better bang for the buck than the combo, maybe the two combo long actings, maybe, and then the inhaled corticosteroid is it's pretty marginal. The effect, I think, overall. So it is delayed for me. How do you talk about it with patients? It's hard because these, you know, I always say something very simplified, like maybe 1 in 10 patients will feel better on this. But we can't tell, 1 in 10 more will feel better, but more than that will feel better because they're just going to naturally get better. And that'll be hard for us to sort out for you. But if you come back and you're feeling better, we can continue it for a while until you want to try and stop it.
Yeah. And I think probably one of the better messages is what do you do when the person is going to have fairly regular symptoms. So, you know, what I've seen is confusion about which ones to use. And this is not a study-based thing, but I would suggest that what every patient should have a salbutamol inhaler. Yep. And that is what you use when you're acutely short of breath. I've talked to so many people, they'll say, well, you know, when I get short of breath, which of these am I supposed to use? Do I use it? What, you know, which one should I use? In theory, if you're using, it depends on the different inhalers, but some of the inhalers that have long acting beta agonists, some of them do have beta agonists that work acutely, but it's way too confusing to try and remember which one it is. And you probably shouldn't be using them that way anyway. So I think you should have, these are the medications you take every day, and we can debate about once or twice a day and so on. And this is the one that you use for symptoms. At least that's what I would do. I don't know if there's any other better answer. But
it's kind of like the whole idea of managing pain. This is what you take every day for your chronic pain, and this is what you use for breakthrough pain.
Yeah.
Right?
I can't think of any better way to do it. And at least I know that way I'm not... I also know that, you know, the least expensive inhaler is going to be the one that you're going to be using regularly, like at least for symptoms.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So now there's still a couple of other studies and nuances that we need to put to this. I'm just looking at the clock here. We're at about just over 30 minutes. So I think we've got enough stuff for another podcast. So I think, why don't we just, in the next podcast, Jamie, what are we going to talk about in the next podcast? Why don't you just give us a quick synopsis?
Yeah, well, I think there's a number of, I think it's the nuances that can come up. Number one would be, we've got a trial that just came out in June, the ETHOS trial, which has striking similarities to the IMPACT trial, but both of them have some interesting stuff when we look at that mortality outcome that I think is interesting to talk about, and exacerbation rates and people that were on inhaled steroids prior and what that looked like. We get into kind of the dangerous zone of subgroup analyses. Because Mike really wants to talk about eosinophils, we could probably talk about that as well.
Yeah.
And there's always the topic of pulmonary rehab that can come up too. But I think the list could go on.
Yeah. So why don't we do that? We'll do that in the next podcast, and then Mike, as always, we'll wrap it up in a nice box and put a bow on it.
Mm-hmm. And focusing primarily, of course, on what, James?
How can you make more money?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, that's not it.
I love the way you think. No, eosinophils.
Oh, okay.
I don't know how many times we're going to have to go over this, because we prepped before we brought Jamie on board.
Yeah.
Then we prepped with Jamie. Then we prepped in the previous podcast.
I know. I'm sorry.
These surrogate markers, they're tough for you.
I know. I think we will leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.